This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello everyone, welcome to this week's edition of the Spanish Football Podcast. I'm Phil Kitchmalides, joined by Dr. Sid Lowe. Hello, Sydney.
Hello, Philip. How are you?
I got a little bit of a cold.
Oh dear.
It feels like a lot of people in Madrid have got a bit of a cold right now. The cold snap has come.
It definitely has. It's absolutely pissing down with rain.
Pouring with rain, I was going to say. Yeah, pouring with rain and grey and a little bit chilly. But we've had lots of decent football to warm us up and entertain us over the weekend. So let's get right to it. Match day 14. Went a little bit like this. Friday night saw Levante and Athletic Club play out a 0-0 draw. On Saturday, Celta and Villarreal also played out a draw. It finished 1-1. Two pretty big goalkeeping howlers from either keeper leading to both goals. Then Sevilla and Alaves played out a 2-2 draw. Sevilla had won all five of their previous home matches this season, but Alaves were 2-1 up heading into injury time before Ivan Rakitic scored a late equaliser for Julian Lopetegui's side. It absolutely poured down with rain in Sevilla, biblical downpour, and it was really nice and sunny in Vigo in the game before, so it was a little bit weird, the weather on Saturday in Spain. Then Atletico Madrid beat Osasuna 1-0 at the Wanda Metropolitano, a late goal from Felipe, of all people. He's been much criticised, the Brazilian centre-back, this season, but he popped up with an important header and a very impressive acrobatic celebration to give Atletico Madrid all 3 points. And then you were in Barcelona, Sydney. You were at the Camp Nou for the first game of the Xavi Hernandez era, his first match in charge of Barcelona. It happened to be the Barcelona derby against Espanyol. The hosts won, Xavi's side won, by a goal to nil, scored from the penalty spot by Memphis Depay. More on that to come. Sunday saw Getafe thrash Cadiz by 4-0, 3 thumping headers and a brilliant goal from Jaime Mata in injury time to round off an absolute rout for Getafe. Then Real Madrid won really, really comfortably, one of their best performances of the season, 4-1 at Granada. Vinicius Jr. getting amongst the goals, his 8th of the season. He's absolutely flying. Betis thrashed Elche by 3-0. It turned out to be the final game in charge for Fran Escribá as manager of Elche. He was sacked after the game. We'll talk a bit more about that, but they did defend absolutely abysmally in the first 27 minutes of that game, where Betis scored 3 goals. They were 3-0 up at halftime. It could have been 6 or 7. And then the final game of the weekend saw Real Sociedad and Valencia play out a 0-0 draw, the game that you were at, Sydney. We'll talk about that as well. Monday is the game between Rayo and Mallorca. I was just telling you before we came on air, I don't think I'm going to make it to that one, much as I would love to. It is pouring with rain. I do have a little bit of a cold and I don't have childcare anyway, so that's my excuse. My missus isn't back from work in time, so I can't go. But I would love to. You're going, aren't you? You lucky boy.
Well, I don't know if lucky is really the right word for it. Looking out that window,
you could
there's
have done
a bit of me that
this,
thinks, you know, yeah. There's a bit of me that thinks, you know, if I hadn't applied for accreditation already, maybe I wouldn't be going, because I'm always very reluctant to let people down on accreditations and stuff.
It'll be great once you get there. It'll be fantastic. If you join us over at patreon.com/TSFP this week, we'll have a Q&A pod out tomorrow answering all of your questions. We'll have a bonus pod on Thursday talking this week's Champions League games and the final episode of our TSFP Presents series, Messy Moments, which will come out on Friday. You also get access to our Discord. We're chatting away all the time on there and interacting with all the different patrons. It's €4 a month. It's €1 a week. It's a very small amount of money for quite a lot of content. So if you fancy it, come and join us. Right, the talking points from this week will obviously start in Barcelona at the Camp Nou in that first game in charge for Xavi Hernandez. I mean, only been there a couple of days, only had a couple of training sessions. Were there any major differences you could spot, Sid, from Xavi's Barca? Bearing in mind, you were also pitch side, so that does kind of condition how you see the game.
No, I was fortunate enough not to be pitch side.
Oh, you weren't?
Pitch side pre-game, but I was up in the stands for the game.
Oh, that's good.
I had a slight dash just before the game started, but I was there in plenty of time. Was there anything different? Yes, I think there was. And I think the question mark really is which part of the game you take to make your analysis with. And I think Xavi was entitled to say, as he did after the game, that for 65, 70 minutes, he was quite pleased with this. Now, I personally think that 65, 70 minutes might be pushing it a little bit.
Yeah.
I think it might be a little bit less than that.
Yeah, but first half.
I do think, broadly speaking, you can certainly take the first half.
Yeah.
And you can maybe take a little bit of the second half as well. I think what we saw, and I suppose on one level at least, this is natural, because bear in mind that Xavi Hernandez has been in charge for 12 days and had only had two training sessions with all his players available because they were coming back from the international break. So I think what we saw was some shift in the intentions of the team, the way that they want to play. And at times, they clearly did some of those things. Mm. But I think we then saw, if you like, a revert to type, or at least a revert to recent type. I think we saw some of the concerns that they have, some of the vulnerability and some of the, if you like, the lack of character to maybe believe in those ideas that they're trying to impose or to believe that they are truly capable of imposing them. And I think part of Xavi's role will be, of course, to try and reinforce that sufficiently that there is the confidence to do some of the things that he wants them to do. Now, let me try and explain what some of those things are. Before we kind of then talk about the moments in which it started to break down. And look, just another thing to put this into context. I was talking to a manager the other day and he was sort of saying with Xavi, he said, yeah, Xavi, you know, it's all well and good. He said, but the reality is, and I apologise for individualising this, but I'm going to because this is the way I was told it.
Right.
The reality is that's still Oscar Mingueza on the ball.
That's a bit mean. Poor old Oscar.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, it's about if you like, expressing the, you know, what the situation is.
Where we're at right now.
So let's start from the start. What we saw that was different. Well, first of all, we saw the starting lineup, and I think that in itself was significant.
Mm-hmm.
And why was it significant? Well, because Elias started. Now, Elias is a 17-year-old kid who hadn't played for Barcelona yet.
Who plays for the under-19s. He doesn't even really play for Barca B. I think he played four times
exactly.
for Barca B.
That's right. Four times for Barca B and two goals in a game against Sevilla, which Xavi was at on his first day at the club. He went to watch Barca B that evening. He saw Elias score two. I'm going to point out at this stage, at the risk of sounding like I'm hanging medals on myself, but let me do that anyway. This is a kid that people have been talking about for a while. Now, some of our listeners will know that once a year, The Guardian does this next generation thing. And this year, where you choose the outstanding players of that generation, this year it was kids born in 2004. And I was asked to come up with four from Spain. I had a rather long shortlist, I think, of eight players in the end. And Elias was on it. He didn't make the final cut. Gavi did. For obvious reasons, because by then Gavi was already playing in the first team and we could see that he was special. Elias didn't, but the people that I'd spoken to, which included people at the Federation and scouts that I know, had said, you know, this is a kid that we think is going to be very good. Xavi had been to see him play and decided to play him. Now, why does that matter? Beyond the fact that it's a 17-year-old getting his debut, why it matters is because this happened because of Xavi's determination to play with wide
yes.
open wingers.
Yes.
With wingers right on the touchline. And to be honest, with Dembélé out, with Ansu Fati out, and with Sergiño Dest out, he didn't have one.
I suggested that this selection for Elias, when I was talking about it on La Liga TV yesterday, was indicative of three things. The fact that La Masia is super important, the fact that it's going to be a meritocracy under Xavi Hernandez, and that he wants to play with wingers. Clearly, maybe actually, really, though, the most important thing is that third one, the fact that the wingers is non-negotiable. That's the most important thing.
Let me add a fourth one to that, which is that those first three things that you talk about are all true. And then the fourth is the one I was getting onto, which is circumstance. Mm. So you want wide wingers, you want the pitch to be opened up, and that is non-negotiable as far as Xavi is concerned. And without Dembélé, without Ansu, and without even Sergiño Dest, and of course without Dani Alves, who's not available to play until January, you don't have someone who can open the pitch on that side.
You can ask Coutinho to do it. You can ask.
Yeah, but you know that he's going to drift inside. You know that he's not going to stand right out on the touchline. And actually, in the end, he did ask Coutinho to do it. Yeah. He came on and played, 20 minutes. But, so you have this situation where you have to find people to open the pitch. So he plays Gavi on one side and Elias on the other. He then takes Elias off at half-time and puts on Abde. Yes. Another winger, another youth team player. I believe he's 2 years old. I think he's 19, rather than 17. He's a little bit more direct, a little bit more physical, I think, of the two of them. Or at least that was the sign of it from the game. So that was important. Why? Because it showed us that Xavi wants his players high and wide to open the pitch out, not just because it puts players in wide positions, but of course it opens space for the players inside. Because in theory, at least, you draw the defenders out to you and you make those lines of passes longer to the touchline. So that was one thing. That goes hand in hand with another thing, which is we did see them play higher. We did see them press higher. We did see that defensive line right on the halfway line a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And we saw them pushing right the way up to try and squeeze the whole of the game into the Espanyol half. And I think you could argue, or well into the Espanyol half, I think you could argue that it worked as a structural approach, right? Now, let's not talk about how well they played or how many chances they made or goals. As a structural approach, I think it worked because you saw Espanyol push right back into the area. Barcelona dominate possession. I think it was 70% at halftime. And Vicente Moreno was asked after the game whether his approach was wrong because they played very, very low, very, very deep. And might they have done better had they attacked Barcelona more, as was demonstrated by the fact that they got chances later in the game, which mm-hmm. we'll come to in a minute. Mm-hmm. And he argued, well, yes, or maybe not. Because we didn't necessarily choose to do that. Partly that was them pushing us right back. And you see this reality and you back off. And I think, so Xavi sort of got what he wanted. Now, what's the problem with this? The big flaw in this, or the flaw at least seen by Saturday, they created one absolutely brilliant chance for Elias very early on, which he smashed over the bar from about 6 yards. And that might have changed everything. There was a very good save that Diego Lopez made from Memphis Depay low down to his left-hand post, near post.
Yeah.
And there was a good save that he made from Busquets from a shot around the edge of the area. But most of what Barcelona did in terms of the shots they created, in terms of the chances, if you can call them chances, were shots from around the edge of the area. I don't think they got past Espanyol as much as they would like. So we were confronted by a similar flaw, which is that little touch of creativity in the areas of pitch where it really matters, or the ability to create a chance, mm-hmm. was still not there. Now, that may well come with time. Then the other big flaw we got, by the way, in that structural thing, I wonder if at some point there's a question mark to be made about Memphis Depay, who I think is a very good player. I think he's a strong player. I think he's a pivot that you can play off. But does he sometimes hold the ball a little bit longer than you want that centre forward to do if you want to keep the rhythm of the circulation of the ball going and keep it high? And I wonder if sometimes that happens with Depay, which isn't to say he's not a good player, because I think he is. But I just wonder if it's, in terms of this structure, this approach, whether it works. Then, of course, you get the other problem, which is that Barcelona do get the goal that they're looking for.
Yeah.
They get it from a very ropey penalty.
Yes.
So they've not really had a huge amount of creativity yet. And then with, I don't know if it's immediately after the goal, I don't know exactly when to place this. As I say, Xavi placed this at around about 70 minutes. I would place it a bit earlier, maybe 60, but I'm not really sure. Barcelona lost control.
Mm.
And they lost the thing that Xavi wants most of all, yeah. which is the ball.
Yes.
And they lost control of the ball. And so this doesn't necessarily disprove Xavi's theory, because, of course, he made the point after the game, we needed to have the character then to keep the ball, to play in their half, to pass it, to not let them have it. And I actually think he's right, mm-hmm. even if you could say, well, it's a bit stereotypical because it's his discourse, as we know his discourse is. Mm. But I think he is right about that. The problem then is, of course, you then have to ask the question, well, why? Why did they lose control? Why can't they keep this going? Xavi says he thinks it's not about physicality. It's not that they had a physical collapse as the game went on, even though we've seen this before And sometimes you wonder if it's physicality. Maybe it's just because they've too many bad habits ingrained. Maybe it's because the new habits haven't been ingrained yes. enough for them to cling on to them in moments of doubt. And I think that's what happened. And the other thing Xavi said, which I think is really important, and I think we don't hear often enough, even if it might sound like an excuse coming from Xavi, I think we don't hear it often enough, and I certainly think it's something we should say, they were up against a really good team who good. Are very well worked and who know what they're doing. And Raúl Tomás in particular played very, very well.
Good. I'm glad you mentioned Espanyol, because we would be doing them a massive disservice if we didn't talk about them as well. We'll talk about the chances that they missed. We don't talk about referees, really, on this podcast at all. But the penalty that was given to Barca was a ridiculous decision. I mean, quite frankly, I've seen it time and time again, and I have no interest. I am not in any way biased. I don't support Barcelona. I don't support Espanyol. I do not support Real Madrid. I was just looking at this completely objectively. It's an absolutely ridiculous decision. But anyway, by the by, and you agree with me, right?
Well, I do agree with you. I don't think it's a penalty okay. at all. I kept watching it thinking, I've missed something here, because it seems so clearly not a penalty to me that I thought, I must have missed something.
There is some kind of contact on the ankle right, as he's already going down. And because there's touch, because there's ankle, because there's yeah. a bit of contact, that's the protocol and the VAR can't intervene.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly the point I was going to make. So now I don't need to make it. Why do we have this protocol with the VAR that says, rather than look back and see if there's a foul, it's look back and see if there's contact? No, that's not the point. Or it shouldn't be the point. But it's their way, to be fair, it's their way of interpreting whether it's a clear and manifest error. Because they're saying, well, if there's contact, it can't be clear and manifest. And it's up to the referee to decide whether the contact is sufficient or the rest. Yeah. Anyway, let's not, because we'll drive ourselves mad.
Espanyol created 4 really good chances. 2 of them hit the post. One brilliant Raúl de Tomás header. Another brilliant Raúl de Tomás free kick. And then Lanry Di Mata missed an unforgivable chance with his head from 6 yards out. It's a brilliant ball in. He doesn't even have to jump. All he has to do is head it into the back of the net, and he doesn't even hit the target. There was also a chance for Woulé right at the end as well in the 95th minute. How Espanyol didn't score, I've no idea, because it's incredible that they didn't at least get something out of this game.
And I must confess, by the way, I didn't realise that Raúl de Tomás's free kick hit the post.
It did, it clipped it just on the outside.
Yeah, from where I was, it was the side netting. I hadn't realised it hit the post. So, which is just my excuse for not writing in the match report, but Espanyol twice hit the post. I didn't have them twice hitting the post. I had them missing 3 clear chances rather than twice hitting the post.
That's all right.
The header, I was talking to rival podcasters Rick Sharma and Sam Marsden after the game.
Okay,
and I must confess, I can't remember if it was.
Yeah.
No, I know, I know. I must confess, I don't know if it was Rick or Sam now, because they were both sitting there when I went down into the press room afterwards. But it was as the old London cliche used to go. It was a 50p header, wasn't it? It's like you've got a head shaped like a 50p, so the ball bounces off at a funny angle. Because it is such a good chance.
Yeah.
And you're right, he doesn't need to jump. And Vicente Moreno said afterwards, you know, you get this chance 10 times, you score 9 of them. Well, this is the one that you don't score. Really, really bad miss. The Raúl de Tomás header against the post, I don't think you can call it a miss. I think it's a really good attempt that hits the post. I think Espanyol made chances. And as I say, the main thing was the threat. One thing I'd like to add about Raúl de Tomás, by the way.
Yes.
In that part of the game, which, you know, we've established was at least the first half, maybe 60 minutes, in which Espanyol were put under pressure by Barcelona, they had one outlet, and that outlet was Raúl de Tomás. And the quality of Raúl de Tomás's control when the ball was dropping to him from height about 4 times in that first half was unreal. And I'm going to admit, I didn't have him down, Raúl de Tomás, as technically especially exquisite, if you see what I mean. I had him down as a very good footballer. I had him down as someone who could do really good things occasionally, but not, if you like, the softness of touch that we saw at the weekend, which I was really, really impressed by.
Mm. He's an exceptional player who's getting better. You can see he's developing,
he really
he's
is.
Improving.
Absolutely, he is. Yeah.
And that's if he keeps doing this, unfortunately, for Espanyol, he might not stay there for very long. But yeah,
I think that's true.
He's doing brilliantly. All right, let's move on. If there's anything that we've missed and you'd like to ask us a question, join us at Patreon and we'll answer it on the Q&A pod tomorrow. But we'll move on and discuss Real Madrid's thumping 4-1 win at Granada. It was really quite comfortable. For Real Madrid, Granada had Monchu sent off in the second half for a lunge at Vinicius. Vinicius causing them all sorts of problems. The goal that he scored is such a good goal, not because it's his finish, because it's basically a tap-in, but the way that it's created, it's a stunning, stunning collective goal involving Casemiro, Benzema and Luka Modric, 36 years of age, just sprinting forward to get involved in the attack. It's a fantastic team goal. It's Real Madrid's third goal. If you haven't seen it, go and see it just to appreciate what we're talking about. But of the four goals, there were four assists from midfield. Kroos set up the first two, Modric the third, Casemiro the fourth. As a unit, Real Madrid have got their first 11 pretty much sorted, apart from right wing. I think it's either going to be Asensio or Rodrigo, probably not Hazard, probably not Bale. And then everyone else is, we know who is going to be in that first team. They look like a serious unit now, Real Madrid.
They do. And in a way, this takes us back to something that we were talking about, I don't know when it was, 3-4 weeks ago, when I was saying that there just isn't a team in Spain that has the players that Real Madrid have. In terms of the elite level, if you see what I mean. Mm. So I don't know if there's a team that's got a player as good as Benzema. There's not a team that's got a midfielder as good as Kroos or Modric. Although who knows if maybe one day Frenkie de Jong will be that good. Obviously, Sergio Busquets has been, and perhaps in the right structure could be.
Pedri.
And we don't know how Pedri and Gavi will develop. But yes,
Lamar.
But what I mean is you. I don't think Lamar's at that level, to be honest.
Okay.
This is what I mean. I think the technical quality of Kroos and Modric. No one else has got. I don't mean the technical quality of Benzema, anyone else has got.
No.
I don't even think anyone's got a goalkeeper as good as Courtois at the moment.
Yeah.
Although, obviously, Oblak and Ter Stegen are wonderful goalkeepers.
Mm, yeah.
And in terms of the excitement, Vinicius. No one's got a player as exciting as Vinicius right now, except perhaps if he gets fully fit, Ansu Fati. Now, so you look at these midfielders, and I sort of, this is one of the things that I said to you and Al on WhatsApp yesterday. I was thinking about this. Over the course of the season, at various points or another, been thinking, you know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, Imanol Alguacil said that Mikel Merino is the best defender in Spain. And to be honest with you, I don't...
Best midfielder.
Sorry, midfielder. Did I call him defender? Yes. Sorry, midfielder in Spain. And to be honest with you, I don't actually think he was necessarily wrong. But this is what I was thinking yesterday, and as I said to you...
Define best.
Right, well, here we go. This is part of the point. This is what I was kind of thinking yesterday and why I sent it to you now. Who is the best midfielder in Spain? Well, 1 week it's Merino. 1 week maybe it's Soler. 1 week maybe it's Sergio Canales. 1 week maybe it is De Jong if he has a really good game, or Gavi. But every week it's Modric and Kroos. By which I mean that these two have it's, this isn't to claim that they've not had a drop-off, because Modric started last year really badly. Finished it brilliantly, but started last year really badly. Kroos has had moments when physically he hasn't looked that good, and every time he plays in central midfield, I think he's borderline disastrous, to be honest, because I just don't think that's his natural position. And he doesn't have the, what do you call it, the, what do you call repliegue or the retorno? He doesn't have the kind of the recovery speed when he's out of position in that role. And when he's forced to turn back, he doesn't get back very quickly. But the sort of the consistency of the quality of performance from Kroos and Modric, going back basically a decade now, not quite, but nearly, is just unbelievable. And I just think these two are just basically better than everyone else. And, you know, this is something that we raised when we were talking about Martin Ødegaard, and, you know, our disappointment at how few opportunities Ødegaard got, our disappointment at how bad it went at Real Madrid, not least because I think we could all see it coming. We wanted him to stay at Real Sociedad, where we knew he would play every week, where he would feel important, where he would carry the weight of the team and all that kind of stuff. And we've said even then, yeah, but the bottom line is, if everyone's fit, who plays? Him or Kroos or Modric? Well, it's not him. It's not him. And so this leads us to the question about Real Madrid. As you say, they've got a really good unit now. And by the way, so I think Asensio is very interesting, because Ancelotti was trying to reinvent him as an inside midfielder. And has decided, no, I'm not going to do that. He's going to play at the top. And the same three are going to play, and he's going to play at the top. And that's how we get everyone in this team. And at the moment, it's easy because Hazard doesn't exist, Bale doesn't exist, and Rodrigo still very young and slightly inconsistent.
And was injured as well, yeah.
And was injured.
Just coming back from injury.
And that's the thing. Real Madrid, I think, have problems beyond that starting 11. But I don't think anyone's got a starting 11 as good as theirs.
They're now top of the table, overtaking Real Sociedad by a point. They've also got a game in hand as well on the Basque side. So, yeah, looking good if you're a Real Madrid fan at the moment. But obviously, there is a long, long way to go. Tell me about the game in San Sebastian then between Real Sociedad and Valencia, because it finished 0-0. It was a game without too many chances, without too many goals, scoring opportunities. Well, without any goals, without too many goal scoring opportunities. There was a red card as well with Aritz Elizondo being sent off. It was a feisty day Sunday, actually. Each of the last three matches had a red card. But yeah, tell me how you saw the game and who impressed you from pitch side, because you were pitch side.
I was pitch side for this one, and that was kind of part of that's part of the answer, I think, because certainly people watching this on telly thought it was dreadful. and I thought it was quite enjoyable precisely because it was a feisty game. And pitch side, as I've said before, you get a sense of the athleticism, you get a sense of the lingering menace as well. And that happened very early. There was a moment right at the start where Cillessen confronts... is it Isak? I can't remember who it was now. It might be Isak. And right at the start, he thought, oh, here we go then. This is going to get a little bit tasty. And the other thing that was very striking, and I apologise for this, because it makes me think that I've yet again become too Spanish and I'm no longer English enough. But right from the start, I was thinking, the referee needs to start blowing some fouls here, or this is going to get out of hand. Now, I much prefer a referee to let it go. But he was letting everything go. And you could see that at some point, he was going to have to go the other way and start whipping out the cards like mad. You know, like a croupier on crack. He was just bam, 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 cards coming out everywhere. And it was it was kind of inevitable. And obviously it's partly inevitable because this is the way that Bordalas approaches things, because this is what Valencia feel that they have to do. By the way, being pitch side, I spoke to Jasper Cillessen after the game. And I basically got told, mate, you're an idiot, you haven't got a clue. Because I said to him, you know, essentially I asked him what the thinking was of a lineup with five in midfield, because they played kind of three central midfielders. And he said, well, I don't know who told you it was five in midfield. He said it was three up front. I was thinking, well, they
weren't.
See,
I told you, mate, just stop overthinking these questions, all right? Just go touchline, just go, yeah, tough game, huh? That's all you have to do, all right?
I mean, to be fair, it was the third or fourth question. The first question was basically, right, okay, tough game, huh? Right. And I actually asked him about the fact that it was boiling over, and he'd said, yeah, the referee could have given a few fouls early on, and it got, I think he said, it got interesting, let's put it that way, or something that.
It usually does get interesting with Valencia, yeah, who do have the most fouls per game, unsurprisingly. I was obviously at work doing the game, and Pete Jensen was on co-coms, and he made the Freudian slip, the very, very understandable Freudian slip, and he called Valencia Getafe a couple of times, because obviously José Bordalás used to manage Getafe and had them playing in a similar way to how Valencia are now playing.
Yeah. In response to your question, by the way, in terms of players who stood out, it was a tough
Soler
game. Yeah, absolutely. Two players stood out because of control in the madness, and that was Soler and David Silva. Although David Silva, I felt, was never really in areas where he influenced the game. So when he got the ball, it looked calm, but he was never really in a place where it mattered, I didn't feel. Whereas with Soler, I felt he really was. I thought he looked very, very good close up. And the other player was at least in the madness, and considering he was singled out for some pretty serious treatment, I thought, in the first 20 minutes or so, Adnan Januzaj was at least prepared to go at Valencia and keep going at them, despite getting a bit of a kicking quite a bit. And he's got a little edge of, I don't know if it's cockiness or nastiness about him, which I quite like.
He does.
But yeah, it was very disappointing from Real Sociedad. And one of the things that was noticeable in the last 5-10 minutes, when Valencia actually made a couple of chances, there's a header, and it's Maxi, isn't it, the header, I think, and then there's the one that Gaia almost gets to at the far post. At that point, you could see very clearly, and this is something that Ramiro kind of confirmed after the game, that they were looking around and thinking, you know what, actually, a draw is all right, despite the fact that it takes top spot off us.
To be honest, unsurprising that it wasn't a goal fest at the Reale Arena. I'm just going to read a tweet from my colleague at La Liga TV, the excellent commentator Tim Lee, who's pointed out that Real Sociedad haven't scored more than one goal at home in any game this season. They scored one against Rayo, it was a penalty. One against Levante, it was deflected. None against Sevilla. One against Elche, which was a defensive error. One against Monaco, which was a set piece. One against Mallorca, goalkeeping error. One against Athletic Club, which was a penalty. One against Sturm Graz, which was a set piece. And none against Valencia. So while they've been top for the last 5 weeks, they're not anymore. They haven't been doing it by blowing teams away at home. Certainly not. Certainly not. And yesterday they did. They lacked a bit of goal, to coin the Spanish phrase once more. But
yeah, I mean, that might be changed by the return of Mikel Oyarzabal, who played, what was it, 25 minutes. But of course, he played 25 minutes, but within, I think, 10 of him being on the pitch, Elustondo was sent off. By the way, Elustondo, when he was sent off, I don't know how clear this was on the telly, he kicked a ball into the crowd very, very hard from about 5 metres. Genuinely, if anyone had been in the way of that...
They would have been in trouble. I saw them basically throwing, I think one of the coaches basically grabbing him and just throwing him off and saying, that's it, just get off now. Quick word on Fran Escribá being sacked. Slightly unfortunate for Escribá, who had done a fantastic job with Elche last season in keeping them up. It was also their second time that he's been in charge of Elche. He's one of the most successful managers. I'm going to use another tweet from Tim Lee, who's been studying.
Yeah, I love this tweet. I think I know which one I'm going to say.
Elche have finished above the Premier División relegation zone 3 times in the last 44 years. On each occasion, Fran Escribá was in charge. So it feels a little bit unfortunate for them to sack him.
But you know what? I can understand it.
Because of the squad they have now.
Let me do the sort of the slightly flippant opening line, which actually is how I've written today. Pissing off your boss is never a good idea. And he had Pippo Benedetto, who is not just the striker, but was also part owner of the club, warming up for the whole of the second half and didn't get on. So, you know, you're not continuing if that's happening. I think the other thing is that even if you look at last season, they survived on the final day when their fate wasn't in their own hands and Huesca rescued them by not winning. They picked up 18 points in 17 games with Escribá last year, which of course extrapolated over a season is 38 points, which is normally enough for survival, but only just. They won 5 games under him, I think, and 3 draws. You look at this season, they've only won twice. They have picked up only 2 points of the last 6 games. They have been a bit unlucky in that they'd only been beaten by more than one goal once until yesterday. But then yesterday got totally taken apart and they fell apart as a defensive team as well as a creative one. And I think the expectation level with the squad they got in the summer probably went against him. But I also think there's another element to that, which is that, and I don't want to be kind of conspiratorial about this, but I think there is an element of this. Just a sort of a disconnect between him and ownership, a disconnect between him and the squad, a sense that he is trying to kind of find out what to do with these players that I'm not completely convinced he necessarily wanted. He is cautious by nature, and I think there's a desire for something else. And to be honest with you, although he's been really, really important for Elche, and although Elche's fans, when they think about him, will wish him well, I don't think there will be kind of an enormous sense of, oh my God, what a disaster letting him go.
I was checking the replies to the official tweet and it was basically like, thanks, Fran, you're a legend, but time to go.
Yeah, so, you know, exactly. And look, you know, they are in the relegation zone. Now, he said yesterday, you know, I felt that normal phrase, I felt capacitado, I felt able to bring us around, but it wasn't, it wasn't to be. He wasn't given that chance. And I think that, let's see who the new manager is, because lots of slightly unusual names being thrown into the mix, including Hernan Crespo, which would be great, wouldn't it?
It would, and it wouldn't be entirely surprising if it was Hernan Crespo, given his nationality. Obviously, he's Argentine. The owner of Elche is Argentine. 7 members of the squad are Argentine as well. So let's see if an Argentine manager ends up at the Estadio Martínez Valero. That's it for today's edition of the pod. Before we go, in the Segunda, Almería beat Valladolid 3-1. They're now 8 points clear at the top of the table. Eibar, who are second, drew 2-2 with Lugo. Tenerife are third. And Malaga beat Las Palmas 2-1. Oviedo, the mighty Oviedo, beat Amorebieta by 2-0. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with the Q&A pod over at patreon.com/TSFP. Please, please join us. It's good fun. We'll have a great time. If not, don't worry, we'll be back here, as we always are, every Monday to look back at the weekend's football. So we'll see you then. Adios.
Cheerio.